Yeah, I see. You've been in a couple of times. I can tell you which books we talked about in the past. We talked about Floating Dragon.
Yeah.
That was really good. I enjoyed that one.
Oh, thanks.
And The Talisman.
Yeah, Steve and I were in. We talked about The Talisman.
No, Steve was not here.
Wasn't he?
No.
Oh.
We may have done another one. I'd have to check my computer.
I don't think so. I think we did two.
Well,
I thought that was you. Steve and I went into a studio, and we talked to some interviewer who was very sympathetic, and for the first time, probably publicly, frankly, we talked very frankly about money, and it was sort of elating, you know, because suddenly there seemed to be so much money attached to The Talisman, and it was a curious experience because normally, you know, you don't talk about that in interviews, and I had a very strange feeling afterward of a kind of elation, you know, that it was fun to talk about that. It wasn't about books at all.
So you do so many interviews, you can't remember anything you talk.
Well, I don't do that many.
Well, some people do.
Some people,
it's just a... I talked to one guy who... Tim O'Brien. I just
oh, really?
Yeah, he's great. He was going to go on a tour that was going to last something like 3 months. And it was going to take him to little tiny towns, or college towns.
Yeah.
A lot of them in the South. The little tiny places where he would give... If he didn't get an interview out of the local paper, at least have a reading at the local college or something like that.
But
it struck me as such a strenuous, arduous tour.
That's it.
All over. I mean, I'm talking about dozens and dozens of places. I had his itinerary.
I've done tours like that that were on a smaller scale, but which were really tiring. On the other hand, I sort of think I ought to do something like that now because it's important to get out there and have people see you and hear your name again. Anyhow, that was a great book, that Tim O'Brien book. Did you read that?
Yes, sir.
Things They Carried?
Very good.
That should have won that bloody award, I think.
Well, he got a National Book Award. I mean, one per person is enough.
Yeah.
Or was it an American? It may have been the American.
It wasn't the ABA. That was
the American Book Award, I think, before they changed the name. They went through a...
Oh, he won one National Book Award, going after Cachado. That's right. Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about you. Here, two books in 1 year. That's really an accomplishment.
It is, really. I'm very pleased.
What do you do in your spare time?
Well, I didn't have much spare time for about a year. After I wrote Mystery, I wanted to publish a book of shorter pieces, and most of those had already been written. I wrote one of the stories in Houses Without Doors before Coco. I wrote one long one during Coco. I wrote another one right after it. And then I wrote Mystery in a sort of a rush. It's a very long book, and it took about a year, which for me is a very good pace. And then when that was done, I thought Houses Without Doors was done. And then another great idea struck me, an idea that I thought was great anyhow. And I wrote another of the long pieces in Houses Without Doors. So that's how I'm able to do two books in a... In
so
a short space of time.
You expanded Houses Without Doors.
Yeah.
Mrs. God, I imagine, was the story.
No. I wrote Mrs. God right after I finished writing the novel before Mystery, which was called Coco.
Mm-hmm.
I missed Coco because I'd spent 3 years on it, and I was very deeply invested in it. It was of tremendous personal importance to me. And so when it was done, I felt grief. I felt bereft. I felt as though I'd lost a baby. And Mrs. God is about a very disturbed American academic who has forced his wife to have an abortion. And he's tormented by the loss of that child. He's haunted by a dead baby. So I think that's where Mrs. God came from, though I didn't have any idea of that at the time.
Well, maybe we ought to speak chronologically and go back to Mystery first.
Okay.
Mystery, I... almost finished with. I'm at the point where the two lodges catch on fire.
Oh, yeah.
And Tom is in the hospital, and it has been revealed that the shadow is his father.
Right.
And you know what this book reminded me of
to a
degree? It reminded me of a very sophisticated Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew, because here we have a teenage detective Then we have an older presence who kind of guides them.
Right.
And the characters go through all, and there's a girlfriend in the book, and they go through all of these misadventures. It's kind of like the, I think I'm a little older than you are, so I don't know if you remember the afternoon serials on the radio. I grew up with those things.
Yeah.
It reminds me almost of that, because you have a cliffhanger after cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Have I misinterpreted this?
No, I think that's probably embarrassingly on the money, that there is a big slug of that kind of story in that novel. It certainly wasn't supposed to be like that, and when I started the novel, I didn't intend it to be in that way. It was going to be much, much darker, but the novel itself kept moving me rather than the other way around, and it wanted very much to be about this old man, Lamont von Heilitz, who is a famous detective, but retired and rather in disgrace, and his relationship with a young boy. You spill the beans by saying the boy is his son.
Well, I won't take that far on the air when I edit this for Aries.
Oh, okay.
I don't like to give away the ending.
But anyhow, there is... Probably the pacing of it is sort of like slightly like a Hardy Boys novel. There's a lot more going on, and there's a lot more corruption and betrayal and anxiety in mystery than there ever was in any Boys Adventure novel. But actually, I think some part of me is always attracted to that model, because again and again, quite unwillingly or unconsciously, I've gone back to it. That is, I've gone back to stories of immediately preteen boys or just post-pubescent boys engaged in something rather either adventurous or dire. And it seems to be something my imagination likes, because I keep wandering back to that place.
Tell me about the locales in this. Before I go that far, in most or many of your pieces, including some of those in the houses mm-hmm. outdoors, there are fantasy elements and elements of horror. At first, I thought we were going to have some in mystery, because where Tom gets struck by the car, I mean, he goes out of body, and this hasn't happened up to this point, unless you throw it in at the very end. I mean, I'm almost at the end. I'll be able to finish it tonight, but you haven't done that with this particular novel, so you've stayed away from that element, haven't you?
There is no real overt horror in that book, just as there was no overt horror in Coco, and there's very little in the collection called Houses of the Outdoors. On the other hand...
Well, you've got some ghosts and things in there. I mean, that's... well.
In Houses of the Outdoors, in one of the stories, there may be some strange creatures. They might be ghosts, they might be deformed children. It's never quite nailed down. But what there is, I think, is a way of seeing things. I titled Mystery because it was a pun. That is, we have mystery novels and we have mystery. We have the huge, vague, enigmatic unknown. In England, there used to be mystery plays that were about the church matters. I meant both meanings of that word to come into play. Tom is killed when he's a 10-year-old boy, and he comes back to life. And all his life, he's haunted by the effects of that experience. He's permanently put out of the frame. He's a little bit aside from ordinary life for the rest of his life. There are things he doesn't know that he wants to find out. In conventional mystery novels, somebody's done something, and you have to find out who did it. In mystery, the questions are larger than that. There's the question of who really is this kid, Tom Passmore, who's at the center of the book. What makes his life the way it is? What makes his parents the way they are? What makes his whole society the way it is? And all this is seen through a consciousness that is prone to moments of wonder and awe. So it seems to me that it's far more inclusive than crime novels generally are. It's, as you can see by the size of it, it's a lot longer than they are. And that, it seemed to me, was because there was so much more I had to pack in. There's a lot more detail. There are moments when things stop for a bit and the main character simply looks at something. And he looks at something because he's, at that moment, by some kind of analogical process, trying to work things out. If you look carefully enough, the general theory is you can see everything, you know.
Well, he's certainly a precocious hero. I mean,
yeah.
You don't describe his physical appearance so much, I don't believe, but I can almost visualize him by his actions.
Yeah.
But he's only 17, and he's intelligent and sexually precocious. He presumably loses his virginity on the airplane.
He does, yeah, that's right.
And doesn't stop there.
Yeah.
So you've made a very attractive hero for his youth.
Some people didn't find him so. Some reviewers thought that he was disturbingly passive and not engaged. That is, that things tended to happen to him rather than him directing events. And there is some truth in that. I find him very charming, and I think he's kind of an endearing boy. I think his adulthood will be very troubled, but interesting. He's not a standard hero model to me at all. I think because he is isolated, he's essentially isolated, he's very lonely. He spends his whole summer in a cabin by a lake, and he virtually sees nobody at all. He has one friend who's obviously much less mature than he is, and he has a girlfriend. But the girlfriend can't see him very often. And in the main, he's left alone to swim, take walks, and ponder things. And he tries to work things out, and then by doing so, he causes another big chunk of the plot to come into motion.
We have another engaging hero, too. That's Lamont, the shadow. Tell me about him.
Yeah. Well, he's that old detective I mentioned earlier, and he's sort of, I suppose, Tom Passmore's spiritual father. It is he who sets everything in motion, in a sense, by introducing, by leaking bits of information to his protege, Tom. When I realized I was going to be writing about a detective, I knew that what I wanted to write about was why someone becomes one. What sort of history would impel a person to embark upon a career that consisted of seeking for the answers to questions? And it seemed to me that this wouldn't happen randomly or accidentally, but that a person would decide upon such a career because he had unanswered questions in his own past. Lamont von Heilitz, at the age of 13 or so, walked into his kitchen and found his parents dead. And he spent the next 10 years quite laboriously and in the face of official denial solving that problem of who killed his parents. Tom Passmore is born with a similar problem. Why is my mother so disturbed? Why can't Mom get out of bed most days? Why does she drink so much? Why is my father so angry? This is a real mystery. And he really, virtually against his will, is forced to answer it. And he does find out the answers to all these questions. The answers are buried in his family past and in the past of the island that he was born into.
Tell me about the island. That's kind of unusual. I know it's all the Germanic names.
Yeah. Well, this island in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I grew up, they never noticed when this book was reviewed there that the island of Milwaukee bore certain striking similarities to the city of Milwaukee. So here we have the only German-Polish island in the Caribbean with certain street names that come right out of Milwaukee, a geographical layout that is identical to Milwaukee's, and place names, other place names that are very, very close.
Is that right?
They never noticed it. It was my way of having fun, of amusing myself, of allowing myself to tap certain feelings associated with early childhood and things I remember from the late 40s and early 50s in Milwaukee without completely giving the game away.
Is there a Milwaukee equivalent of the slave quarters?
Not really.
Well, it could be.
That came straight out Charles Dickens.
So that's really interesting. Did they ever find out?
When I went there and told them, they found out.
Uh-huh.
And then they were a little chagrined. In the novel Before Mystery, all the characters get on a plane and go to Milwaukee to talk to try to find certain characters. They find the characters' parents. They go to bars. They conduct interviews. They stay in hotels. And again, when I wrote that, I set events slightly free from earthbound facts. So I invented on top of my emotions. In Chicago, they loved Coco. In Milwaukee, they hated it. I mean, these cities are slightly rivalrous. And what delighted them in Chicago rather disturbed them in Milwaukee. So I thought that in mystery I'd play it a little safer and move everything, you know, 2,000 miles south and have palm trees and hummingbirds.
This could have been the book that made Milwaukee famous. No, it's no coincidence, then, that you set the lodge in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, that's right. Again, that is pretty much a made-up place. But there are certain lakes in Wisconsin where well-off people in Milwaukee do have country houses and where they spend a month or two in the summer. The one I invented is almost ridiculously exclusive and snobbish. Because you couldn't get in there unless you were born owning a spot there, I don't think. But in my own life, I've never been to any such place. But again, it was a lot of fun to make up because of the sort of comedy of that sort of social exclusiveness.
Well, the little town that you write about is kind of interesting because when I was a kid, we used to go to a lake in Wisconsin near the Flambeau Floyge. Uh-huh. A little lake called Boot Lake. And uh-huh. The nearest towns were Mercer and yes. Park Falls, both heavily Indian-oriented with a lot of touristy aspects and so forth. So that brought
Mercer, Wisconsin is very close to the town of Eagle Lake. There's a town called Mercer and a town called Hayward that I remember from my childhood that had these long strips with places where it's selling Kachina dolls and Indian headdresses and funny T-shirts and I pine for you ashtrays.
There was always a place I wanted to visit when I was a kid. My father would just shoot through it. It was called Wisconsin Dells.
Yes.
I always wanted to stop there. I mean, you talk about touristy.
Yeah.
I always wanted to go there, and to this day, I haven't been.
I was just there. My family and I, after a family reunion in the summer, drove back through Wisconsin Dells, and it's hugely touristy now. I think when I was a kid, and you were a kid, it was sort of enjoyable. But now it's like going to Bangkok. You know, people jump out at you in street corners and try to sell you things. And
Indian blankets.
Yeah, God knows what.
Well, let's switch over a little bit to your latest book, which follows Mystery by, a couple of months, I guess, huh?
Well, almost a year.
Oh, that much?
Yeah. Mystery came out. The official date of Mystery was probably January. Oh. And the official date of Houses of Outdoors was November. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of time between them.
Well, Mystery, Houses of Outdoors is a collection of, I guess you would consider them a collection of short stories in novellas.
Because, that's right. So some of those stories are pretty long.
Yeah. The Mrs. God and the Juniper Tree.
And the Buffalo Hunter. That's about 100 pages long, I think.
Those are very long. So that is the correct term, novella.
I would say so, yeah.
Normally a novella is short enough that it cannot be published by itself.
That's right.
Unless you're Saul Bellow.
Yeah, or Joyce Carol Oates, who just published a really great one.
Yeah, 96 pages or so, yeah. 86 pages.
That's right, that's very nice. It's nice to see that, I think.
I love them. I love them when they're short.
Yeah.
Being a book reviewer and sometimes doing as many as 4 reviews a week, you know, when I urge the authors I interview to keep their books to less than 200 pages to make it easy.
My natural impulse is toward 900 pages.
Blue Rose, it's a name that appeared in Mystery and is the title of a short story.
That's right.
In Houses Without Doors. Blue Rose may be my favorite story in here. Yeah. And the people, though, are so unpleasant, such a violent household.
They're very unhappy. I'm haunted a bit by those words, Blue Rose, and by the emotions in that story. In Coco, the main character reads a novel written by another one of the characters about a series of murders in which somebody writes the words Blue Rose on the wall above the victims. In Mystery, Tom Passmore reads that same book. But it all started with that story in Houses Without Doors, in which a budding young psychopath named Harry Beavers hypnotizes and murders his younger brother by using the post-hypnotic suggestion of the words Blue Rose. I wanted, in a way, to write to describe the most dysfunctional family I could imagine. And I saw something like a cookbook for the creation of a serial killer or the creation of a psychopath, which was a very weak, ineffectual father who isn't around very much, a mother who sees herself as of a social station above her family and who is forever frustrated because of her finding herself among whom she considers the plebs. And if you add a little, you know, violence and alcohol into that, the children of those two, one of the children of those two people, if they have enough children, might turn out to be somebody very, very disturbed. Now, when I was a child, my parents weren't like this, but I did hypnotize my little brother, and I did stick a pin in his arm. And this must remind me of certain qualities in myself that I'm not very fond of, you know. That is, I think there is still a certain amount of guilt and shame attached to this, even though it didn't hurt him, because he was hypnotized. And when I said, you will not feel any pain, just the way the book told me, he didn't feel any pain. But still, it seems like an outrageous, and as, to use your word, unpleasant thing to have done. And I wonder what my motives really were.
Isn't this strange? I also did something like that. I didn't stick any pins in my subject, but I also used post-hypnotic suggestion, and it works.
It works.
But the scary thing was the person I had hypnotized with, as a young girl, burst into hysterics at one point. I got very frightened that maybe I couldn't bring her out. Yeah. You know, it's kind of a scary thing to for an adolescent to play with.
It's very scary, and kids should never do this. My father read Blue Rose, and he reminded me that I had hypnotized a whole bunch of children. That he remembered my hypnotizing two of my cousins and my two brothers. So my parents, I guess, sat on one side of a window, I imagine, and watched me, you know, either from the outside in or the inside out, and watched me put smaller children into hypnotic trances. And I did it really just to see if it could be done, if what the book told me I could do was what I could do. Harry Beavers, in the story Blue Rose, has some of the same curiosity, but when he realizes he can do it, a kind of sick disbelief floods through him. And that story really did shake me up. I remember that I loved writing it, that I was just enraptured by the story, but that when I walked downstairs at the end of most days writing it, my knees were shaking. Mm. I felt as though I touched something a little too powerful.
Another story I liked particularly was The Buffalo Hunter, and I love the idea of the character actually getting into the novels. You know,
yeah.
Because, I mean, this is... But many of your stories have all these literary elements that that I like, and this was certainly one of them. I mean, the old detective with Dashiell Hammett stuff.
Raymond Chandler, sorry. Yeah.
How did this idea occur to you?
Well,
if that's a fair question. I don't know if it's fair to ask an author how an idea comes.
I can be very specific about a lot of the stuff in that particular story. First of all, that is what I look for when I read. When that man, Bobby Bunting, opens a book, when he's really lucky, he's not just reading, he's in it. It's better than a movie. He smells the smells, he feels the sensations. Book time is real time. It's as though it's like the world's best game or the world's best theme park. Ordinary reality goes away, and he's in the reality of the book. This is like the ultimate form of transparency. And when I read, what I most want is that experience, to have the world go away and that I be experiencing everything that the characters in the book are experiencing, the more subtle, heartbreaking, extreme, more fully nuanced, more dramatic, or more heartfelt, the best. But it doesn't matter really what kind of novel it is. And if it doesn't happen, if the novel doesn't permit that, then I tend to get impatient with it. The rest of The Buffalo Hunter came from an art exhibit that I went to see of a friend of mine named Rona Pondick, who makes very, very disturbing kind of primal pieces. At the time I saw her show, she was entranced with baby bottles. And she did a lot of work with baby bottles. She strapped them to beds. She stuck them in the baby shoes. She made equivalences between baby bottles and phalluses. And I liked the show very, very much. And the next morning, when I woke up, I found myself wondering what sort of person would do the kind of thing Rona did without an art impulse, if he was just fixated or became obsessed with baby bottles.
And sick, Peter. Sick.
This would be a sick person, but sick in what way? So I just plunged in, and I started writing about this guy gradually getting more and more obsessed. He's a deeply private guy anyhow, that is repressed and inadequate, but very imaginative. And then as soon as I had him open up a Luke short novel and find himself atop a horse about to start shooting, then I realized what the story was really about. That is, it was about interiority. Once I discovered that, then I was gone. And then I could give this character great experiences as well as ignoble and sick ones. And he could experience a kind of radiance, a kind of transfiguration toward which I've been trying to point off and on in book after book. And I could literally give him a moment of real breakthrough when he sees that the world is nothing but beauty, is all good and is all conscious. He has a classic mystical moment, and he knows it. I mean, that echoes in his life. It repeats those great moments he has when he's reading, and in some ways it saves him as a human being.
Isn't it interesting that people like yourself and myself too can read a piece of fiction, and indeed it is like a movie to us.
Yeah.
And I know so many people, including good friends of mine and relatives, yeah, and some of my best friends, in fact, who are not moved by fiction and will not read it.
Yeah.
They will not buy it. If you give them a book, they will not read it. They will read Newsweek. They'll read the Wall Street Journal. But somehow they cannot get into it and they cannot feel and sense the characters and the drama. I just, it's strange to me. I've always done this, and I just wonder why people have such vastly different temperaments.
I don't know. I think it's a terrible pity when people can't do that, because for the people who can do it, this is how you learn about life. Mm-hmm. Certainly it's the way you learn about life when you're young. Later, you can learn about fiction when you do this, but a great writer can still teach you things very, very directly in a bloodstream way that you cannot get from nonfiction. D.H. Lawrence said fiction was the bright book of life, and he wasn't kidding. It is the best way to assess yourself and your world, it seems to me.
Yeah, fiction tells you what people really think, what they really hunger for.
Yeah, good writers.
And their real impulses.
Yeah.
In a way that nonfiction cannot
do,
except in a clinical and valuable way. There's no question about that.
Yeah, Freud's case studies. But Freud's case studies read like fiction. They are like great little enigmatic short stories that almost always end with a patient leaving and Freud saying, well, now this, you know, meant this and this other thing meant that. And the characters, all of the characters' internal mechanisms are laid bare. And you know that he was right. He might have lied now and then, but he was basically right.
Now, Mrs. God, another story I like. Again, I like the literary allusions, but it also had all the trappings of an old-fashioned ghost story.
Yeah.
Which you say maybe not.
Well, I wanted to make it as ambiguous as possible. When I first started to write that, I wanted to write a story about a woman in the late 19th century who went to a country house to care for two children who seemed to be abandoned by their parents. And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. It seemed extremely familiar to me. And then eventually I realized that what I wanted to write was The Turn of the Screw. And since Henry James had already written The Turn of the Screw about a governess who went to a remote country house to take care of two ambiguous but beautiful children, I didn't feel as though I could improve on it much. So it sort of mutated. In the meantime, I'd read a great many stories by a wonderful but sadly unknown writer named Robert Aichman, who wrote what we might call horror stories, but he calls strange stories. The essential thing about Aichman is that nothing is ever explained in his work. There are no rational causes for the things that happen. They are like John Ashbery poems in prose. They're very disturbing, very beautiful. The best ones are very jewel-like. You know you had a great experience, but you couldn't for the life of you describe it. They're like dreams. So I thought I would try to get a little of that if I could. And so this disturbed guy who feels tremendous guilt about having forced his wife to have an abortion goes off to what should be a scholar's paradise, an English country house, which he has free rein to a fabulous library, and he's supposed to do research. Strange things happen to him. The same meal gets served to him every single time. It's a great meal. It's a, you know, loin of veal with morel sauce. He gets the wines get greater and greater and greater with every meal. He doesn't drink much, so every time he has a little bit of, to drink, he either passes out or he gets drunk. He imagines he hears voices, laughter, and finally he imagines that he has discovered the legendary secret of this house, and it has something to do with deformed children or dead children. He imagines he himself has been selected as a sacrificial victim to this house. And maybe he was and maybe he wasn't. I was going to be like Aikman and not make it too clear. When I rewrote it, I put up a few more signposts and I made the roadmaps a little clearer. But there's still a high degree of ambiguity in the end. In the end, he turns into a baby. He's a huge 42-year-old destructive infant at the end. He's absolutely crazy and happier than he's ever been in his life, I think.
Peter, in Woven Through Houses Without Doors, you have some really short pieces, a page or so.
Yeah.
How do you describe those? What are those called exactly?
Those are called interludes.
Interludes.
I decided when the book was all done and really submitted that I wanted to do something like that. Part of my model here was Ernest Hemingway, who in the book In Our Time prefaced every story with an absolutely beautiful, seemingly unrelated descriptive paragraph. They were generally related to World War I. The connection between the Hemingway's paragraphs and the stories they introduced seemed kind of tenuous, but you know that there is a connection. In my case, I wrote little pieces, generally about a page long, that were, in almost every case, quite clearly thematically connected to all of the stories, so that they might even say, they might make the claim that all the protagonists are the same protagonist. That is, that Harry Beavers, who sticks the pin into his little brother, is the same as the boy who is sexually molested in the movie theater, who is the same as Bobby Bunting, who is the same as William Standish. All of these characters generally have something in their lives that they have not faced, that they cannot encompass or come to terms with. And the rest of their lives is determined by how they handle this information. The writer, who is a little boy molested in the theater, comes out with a perhaps constricted but still satisfying life because he does remember what happened to him. Bobby Bunting has something in his life he can't remember, something quite traumatic and overwhelming, and because he has repressed it, his life is repressed. Those interludes are all about either facing it and seeing it or not facing it and not seeing it. There's also woven through a lot of them that kind of hint of transcendence that I was talking about before. In the first of the interludes, a woman sees a young man walking toward her. He seems to be smiling. She sees instead, as he gets closer, that his eyes are wet, and he's grimacing. He's not smiling. Other people, too, seem to be looking at him. She's attracted to him. She doesn't understand anything about him, and he walks past. When all of these stories are over, and we've gone through, as you say, some unpleasant events and seen various tragedies enacted, that woman is back on the same street. It's a year later. She sees that same young man come toward her again. This time he doesn't seem to be crying, but neither is he smiling. On the other hand, a sort of glow seems to encircle him. And whimsically, almost, she decides to walk out of her ordinary life and follow him. A friend of mine read this when the book was still in manuscript, and he said, "Who is this? Is this Jesus here, Peter?" And that hadn't occurred to me at the moment, but I won't write that possibility off. It seemed to me this guy might be kind of angelic, but whatever he is, he's not in the ordinary world. The whole impulse of the stories in general is to remove the reader from the realm of the ordinary world and to put him in a place that might be a lot less comfortable, but where he can experience things he wouldn't ordinarily experience, and what which might give him the opportunity to lift off for a little bit into some kind of transcendence.
These stories, were they written specifically for this collection?
No, I wrote them on and off over about 4 years, simply because they really wanted to be written. I'd read something or I thought of something that suggested a story to me, and generally when that happens, I understand the story and it's not interesting.
But they weren't published elsewhere.
So, anyhow, in this case, the stories did seem very, very interesting, and I didn't understand when I wanted to write them. Two of those stories were published in previous anthologies, mm-hmm. Blue Rose and the Juniper Tree, mm-hmm. but the rest have not been seen before.
Peter, we're almost out of time, but I did want to address something that we kind of touched on before, and that's the creative process. We talked about people who can read fiction or not read fiction, but it's not anything to them.
Yeah.
And there are people that we both know who seem to have no original thoughts, no original ideas. This is the type of person who would not write fiction, obviously.
And yeah.
Obviously, you, with your wide body of work behind you, have original thoughts and original ideas all the time. And I just wonder how this happens and how this develops, because it seems to me the creative process is such a mystery. Talk about mystery.
It is a mystery.
Yeah.
That's right.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, one of my thoughts is that Tom Passmore, in mystery, is in a sense an artist of a kind, except it's all translated into another medium. But that sense of apartness and isolation and loneliness is inherently bound up with the business of living through imagination, which makes it sound a little grim, and I don't mean that to happen at all. In my case, I told stories to myself from the moment I could think. These stories were in aid of solving the world. I wanted to figure it out, and I came up with, you know, one explanation after another, and they were all quite fanciful. And it wasn't, and I had to sort of learn to really look at things and to accept things in a more rational, step-by-step basis. But before I did begin to understand, you know, what made the world work and what, in fact, it was actually like. But that process is what led me into reading the way I read, which was for life, really, for the sake of my own life. When I began to write, I found an enormous satisfaction almost at once, an enormous frustration, of course, but a sense that this was my road. And I didn't know at the time, but the more I did it, the more room I found inside myself. The more, to put that more simply, the more I did it, the better I got at it. The more I understood my own goals, the freer my imagination got.
You probably developed more self-confidence as you went.
Yeah, much more. Since in almost every case, I think, when somebody says they're going to write or they want to try to be a writer, almost everybody you know says, well, you can't do that. You know, good luck, they say. I wish you luck, but you know what the odds are? Your parents say, gosh, I wish you'd try something where you could be sure of making a little money. You know, they see a lifetime of financial dependence before them. Anyhow, when you first get a book published and first start to be able to support yourself, then a whole layer of several geological layers of insecurity drop away, and you know that you can depend on your unconscious to save you, to get you out of spots, to pay the rent, to provide schooling for your children again and again and again.
And isn't it interesting that the creative people don't spring from a disturbed childhood necessarily? Sometimes
no.
They do.
No.
They come from all walks of life, and they are all sorts of some. A good writer does not have to be an alcoholic.
No, thank God.
or mentally depressed all the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've met writers who have big families and they're happy, and I've met other writers who seem to be morose. And there is no one common denominator with regard to the creative impulse.
You know, it's very strange. It's like lightning. It can just hit anybody. And the kind of person it hits determines how it will be expressed. So sometimes I have the feeling that all of cultural history has been determined by who lightning struck, to use my metaphor. That because a particularly sunny, gregarious person had a big, big talent, he helped shape his culture in his own image. Or if a really bleak, depressed, and happy person was shivered by an enormous jolt of talent, then he influences everybody to see the world in that way.
And some of the bleak, unhappy people write the best comedy.
Yeah, that's true. That's right.
Well, it's great talking to you. I'm so late on Mystery. Is there going to be a paperback?
The paperback should be out tomorrow. It should be out very, very soon.
January?
It's an official January date, which means it should be in the stores now, but
that
it isn't. But
that
it will
be soon. Who's the publisher?
NAL.
NAL. Okay. Well, it was good seeing you again, as always, and I liked both of those books, and many of the stories were moving, and Mystery reminds me of the Hardy Boys.
Thanks a lot, Don.
Thank you.